So I'm at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley doing research on finance, but I have a background in applied mathematics. And those of you who've been here a little while, they noticed that this is the third time I give a talk with the same title, which is quite good. It's not going to be the same content though, so you can rest assured on that. But I'm also, the two talks I've given so far, I haven't really presented any results, and I'm not going to present any results today either, because I'm getting into this field, and you know, this is more about open questions, where I think social networks and information networks will have great impact on the theory of finance and asset pricing going forward, and this is a very exciting field, so it's more about discussing what are the interesting topics here. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm first going to talk a bit about U.S. stock markets and some facts and proposed explanations for these facts, standardized facts of asset pricing, and where I think there is more to be done and where network analysis can be of great importance. And then in the second part of the talk, we'll get more into details about that. Okay, so here are some stylized facts about stock returns in U.S. stock markets. Which don't really fit very well with the standard asset pricing models we have. So first of all, stock returns are heavy-tailed. This has been known since back in the 60s, and you know, before then, but that was when sort of theoretical models were developed here. So one example is, and I'll talk more about this, is the stock market crash of October 19th, 1987, when prices decreased at the stock market level with about 20% in one single day, which is about a 20 standard deviation event. So, you know, it's basically something that should never happen if we believe in geometric Brownian motions as a good model for asset pricing returns, for example. Another fact is the so-called excess volatility puzzle, also an anomaly that is difficult to explain. So if we got a very standard model for what decides prices of a stock, then we're going to say, well, the price is P right now, and you know, what is the price going to be? Well, why do we own a stock? Well, in principle, we own it because we want to collect dividends over time, right? That's the value we get from owning a stock. So we get some dividends over T, DT here, and we get them in the future, so we need to do some type of discounting. It's like if you have money on this should be to the power of t, not to the power of t. If you got money on the bank, then money in the future is worth less today than money you actually have today. So this is a standard discounted cash flow model for what should be the price of a stock. This is the price today is equal to the discounted sum of all the dividends we're going to get in the future. And obviously, this is stochastic. We don't really know what the dividends are going to be, so we introduce some expectation operator there, and it looks something like this. Okay. Now, if this is the model, well, then we should be able to compare the volatilities of these two numbers. So this is a time series. We've got the time series here, and we see the price today. Well, then the volatility should be related of the price we see today, how it varies over time, should be related to the volatility of this thing, basically the volatility of dividends we see. Now, if you do this, you check this, that this doesn't hold at all. There's actually a factor of something like 20 to 1, so there's a big excess volatility in prices as compared to how dividends change over time. And this is known as the excess volatility puzzle. So there's like a factor 400 to 1 in the variances if you take the price divided by this volatility of dividends. So this is quite troubling, and it might make us ask, well, you know, how good are these models we have, and how can we explain this? And I'll talk more about this going forward. I just want to sort of list these anomalies here. Another thing is that we have time-varying volatility. So if we look at the daily volatility of stocks or even of the stock market, actually, in some periods of time, it's fairly low. Perhaps the average, as I mentioned, something like 1% daily volatility. But then at some periods in time, it seems like there's some type of regime shift. So for months, for example, after this stock market crash of 1987, volatility was much higher. And we'll see this in graphs that I will show. This is also something that isn't really captured in the standard models we have of asset pricing. And finally, and most intriguing, There seems to be a quite weak relation to information events and stock price changes, which, you know, in a standard model we would want to have some type of a dynamical system, so there's some big information shock. Perhaps everyone will find out that oil prices are going up. And then I got all the investors here, and they take this into account, and now they realize that, well, okay, so now it's going to be more expensive to fly, and, you know, Jeep is probably not going to sell many cars now that you know, are very heavy on fuel, and basically this gives an impact on stock prices, so they go down. That's the type of view we want to have on the stock market. So information gets to investors, and then that's incorporated into the stock market. Obviously, if this is the correct model, when we see these type of events, we would like to be able to connect these to, you know, what was the information event that actually happened. And there have been several studies that have done this. The most recent is FAIR 2002. So they basically look at big stock market changes and then check with news wires what was the information event that would have caused these stock market changes. And actually, in like two-thirds of the times, you can't really find an event that, you know, explains why the stock market changed so much. So this is once again, you know, and this is, what I think the most serious anomaly of them all is that, you know, where do these changes come from? Like this model here doesn't seem to tell the whole story. Okay, so let's just see what the stock market has looked like over the last 40 years or so. Here is the total stock market proxied by the S&P 500. So the S&P 500 is an index, it's a basket of 500 stocks. So we can think of this as the proxy for the whole stock market. So basically, well, it looks quite much like some type of Brownian motion here, right? It's wiggling up and down. You know, if you magnify, which we'll do soon, we'll see that at the very high frequency level, it actually seems to jump a lot more than a standard diffusion process, but you know, it seems pretty random. There are some crashes here, three of them to be precise, in the early 70s, 1974, we had the OPEC cartel, and this is obviously one event where we actually can view it as this exogenous information event. So, you know, in one day, OPEC was formed, and the oil prices increased with something like 400%, and this obviously had a huge impact and caused a recession for several years, and this was bad for the stock market. Then we had the new economy boom and the following crash, which I think all of us remember. And obviously this was a gigantic event. So for example, if you look at NASDAQ stocks, the value of the NASDAQ decreased with something like 80%. So there's a lot of value that disappears when you have these crashes. And once again, well, it's difficult to tell sort of a pure information story. This happened gradually over some time, but clearly people were more optimistic in 1999 than they were in 2002, so you know, you can't tell an information story here. This, the crash of 1987, is more difficult to explain from that perspective. So here we're magnifying the time series of the S&P 500, so in like a three-year interval it looks something like this, so things look fairly much like some random walk, but then we've got this gigantic event here, and if we look at the first finite differences here, so the daily returns, we see that this is a tremendous anomaly. This one day, Monday, October 19th, 1987, when stock prices decreased with something like 20%, or $400 billion disappeared just in one day in stock market value there. And we also see this time-varying volatility. If we look at the returns here before, they're much, you know, the volatility is much lower than afterwards. So we do see the success volatility here. So what was the information event here? Well, actually, no information was revealed between the close of Friday, October 16th of the New York Stock Exchange and the close on Monday, October 19th. So we had this huge crash. Stock markets in Asia and Europe opened before, obviously, the New York Stock Exchange. So, you know, at the opening on Monday, on the New York Stock Exchange, people knew that things were going to happen this day. So the London Stock Exchange was down by something like 9% at the opening. But, you know, still no exogenous information events that you could explain that were actually driving this. Yes, so let me relate this to other markets. Obviously, the stock markets are not the only capital markets that we're interested in studying. So one other field is, for example, the insurance market, where, you know, insurance markets, it's much easier to make a case that events actually are heavy-tailed here. So if we look at catastrophe insurance, well, catastrophes are per definition events where there's a reasonable risk that there's going to be an extreme event, right? And the theoretical models we have, for example, for earthquake energy release leads to these Pareto laws, power laws for the tail of the size of these events. So clearly in these type of markets, we shouldn't be surprised if there are heavy-tailed events. You know, if there's a big earthquake, well, that will impact prices of insurance companies a lot that have these insurances. So here, it's easier to tell a story where exogenous events would create these heavy-tailed distributions. Another market, which is very interesting, is the currency market, where we once again see heavy-tailed returns, but in exchange rates, but more on the high frequency level than at the longer horizons. So obviously, at the very long horizons, it's, you know, the US exchange rate with the Swedish kroner, it's difficult to see a scenario where a kroner will be worth $10,000 or something like that, you know, 10 years from now. I don't think anyone believes that that would happen. But at the very short horizon, we actually see pretty heavy tail events here. So one way of measuring the heavy tailness is to look at the kurtosis of the distribution. And the reference distribution here is the normal distribution. Yes?
So some people might not know what the kurtosis is.
Yes, so that's, I'm getting to that. So the kurtosis is the fourth normalized moment of a distribution. So you take the fourth moment, and obviously if you've got a distribution that decreases very quickly, and then now you multiply it with x, you know, to the power of 4, then you're multiplying far out in the tails with big numbers. So if things decay slower than a normal distribution, then you would get a bigger number. So the normalized fourth moment for the normal distribution is 3, and anything higher than 3 would be viewed as heavy tail with respect to the normal distribution. And if we look here at what the current distribution of currency exchange rates are here, the euro versus US dollars, we see that at very short intervals is actually very high. So the kurtosis at the 15-minute interval is something like 24, whereas if we go to sort of the daily interval, we get down to something like 5, very close, or quite close to the normal distribution. Now, this is once again not really captured well by the classical models for exchange rates. So I'm sure some of you here took some introductory macro course at some point, and you remember that there's the PPP, you know, it's all about purchasing power, and if there's inflation in one country, that will lead to drifting exchange rates over time, and things like this. Well, obviously, we wouldn't expect there to be a lot of news about inflation in the 15-minute horizon, right? So there's clearly something else going on here driving the changes in the exchange rates, and this has sort of, there's been an explosion of literature over the last 15 years trying to explain or approach what happens at the very high interval, at very high intervals. Okay, but we're focusing on stock markets from here on. I just wanted to show that, you know, these are anomalies that we see in other markets too, and in some markets we can explain them with exogenous events, but in other markets it would be a stretch to look for that type of model, and we sort of have to look within to find an explanation for what is driving this. So what are some explanations for these anomalies? Well, for the heavy tail distributions, actually, you know, the best models that we see so far is sort of exogenizing this, and the models that try to endogenously get these heavy tail distributions are very, very stylized, and I will go into detail in a few minutes on one of these models. For excess volatility, well, basically there's some literature that says that, well, it actually depends on, you know, it depends a lot on what the time series properties of these dividends are, and if you've got some strange distributions that are not
captured by the standard assumptions we make. You might actually measure this. The true the volatility is not the right measure because there are some non-linearities here.
And also some people think that when there are some bubbles there, there's basically this simple model we have for what decides the stock price as this discounted sum of cash flows is not correct. They're basically their stock prices are not based on fundamentals, and there are bubbles, and who knows what drives these the sizes of these bubbles. But we don't like these type of of explanations as asset prices, because we want to believe in a world where people are rational. Okay. So let's forget about those for the time being. When it comes to the varying volatility, well, basically you have models that exogenously assume these regime shifts. So there's basically something exogenously happening. Once again, this is not an endogenous event, but clearly, the 1987 crash was an endogenous event. Well, then the following increased volatility, one would believe that would also be an endogenous event. So we're sort of missing something here. And when it comes to the weak relation to information, well, let's talk a bit more about this. There are models where there are sort of multiple equilibria or internal news events that are not happening externally but actually happening within the market that can explain this. So one of these models was developed by Romer in the early 90s, David Romer. So basically, it's a private information model. So the model I showed here earlier, this simple model, we're sort of assuming that everyone gets the same information here. And obviously, if we, this is a very simplified view of the stock market, and it would be nice to have sort of a more detailed view of what is actually happening here at the individual level. So Romer develops a model where there are lots of different investors, and they sit on some piece of private information, or not at least not public information for everyone. So for example, perhaps I've got someone who works for the, a friend who works for the OPEC, and he tells me, by the way, don't buy a Jeep next year because, that's going to be something really expensive for you because something is going to happen to gas prices. So I sort of have some type of hunch that, well, oil prices will increase in the next year. But who am I to know how important this is? If I asked you, what is the correct price of Google today, right? What is a Google share, the value of a Google share? Well, I think most of you would say, well, let me go and check on the internet what the stock price is right now, right? Because the market obviously knows a lot more than I know about what the true price of Google is. So, and this is basically saying that the information that you see in the price is a much, better predictor of what the true value of a company is than the private information you have. So you got all these investors that have this private information, but they don't really use it to start short selling some stocks or buying up on some other stocks, because they're saying that, well, I've got this piece of information, but the market knows so much more than me, so this must be incorporated into prices already. There's someone out there who's much smarter than me. So they trust the prices and they don't really move it. So gradually you could see how there are these dispersed pieces of information that are incorporated, but they don't really change prices because everyone sits there and thinks that there's someone out there who knows more than me and who is deciding the true price of these companies. And then you can have some small exogenous or even endogenous shock. Basically, the stock trades themselves reveal that, well, perhaps there is no other guy who's more informed than me out there. I am actually one of the most informed guys, and it's my information that is important. But this could be very much delayed, after the news event itself was revealed. So suddenly, all these guys realize that, hey, my information is important. And this happens sort of within the system, and now you see this gigantic stocks change. So going into a bit more in detail of what this might look like, so this is... what Romer assumes. He assumes that there are three types of investors that have different types of information. So type one is the most informed investor. So basically think of this as a two-period model. There's today, and then there's tomorrow, and that's when everyone will find out what the true price of the company is. But today we have noisy signals of what the true price of the company is, the true price of the company being P, or the true value of the company being P. So this type one investors, they see P plus some noise. So this epsilon is, you might think of it as some normally distributed noise. Just. And there, let's just make this very simple. So Romer assumes that they all get exactly the same piece of signal. So there are like 100,000 people that get a signal of what the true value is plus this noise term. Then there are type 2 investors that get the same signal but a noisy version of the signal. So they get this plus some independent noise, delta 1. And obviously their information is of poorer quality ex ante than the type 1 investors' information, because this is noisier. And then finally we have type 3, which gets an even worse signal. So there's some delta 1 missing here. So they are even worse off in the information hierarchy than the type 2 investors. Now what Romer assumes here is that there's actually only two types out of the three in the market. So nature decides, basically, with a 50% chance that there are only type 1s and type 2s, and then there's a 50% chance that there are only type 2s and type 3s. Obviously, if I'm a type 1 guy and I'm in the market, and if I have any Bayesian statistical skills, I will realize that we're in this state of the world, right? Because I'm type 1, and then this cannot be the true state of the world. And similarly, if I'm type 3, then I will realize that we're in this state of the world. So type 1s and type 3s, if they happen to be in the market, they will know which state of the world they're in, and the type 3 guy here, for example, knows that, well, I'm the least well-informed and I should trust the market, basically. But the type 2 guys, right, they don't really know what the state of the world is. So they could either be in this state of the world where they're the uninformed guys, or they could be in this state of the world where they're the informed guys. So they don't really know whether they should trust their information or not. And what they're going to do is, well, it depends on their objective function, but typically they're going to, you know, choose some mixture of the two scenarios, and if they're risk averse, so they don't like risky investments, then they're going to put more weight on the bad situation for them, which is when they're the uninformed guys. So they're basically going to behave as if there's a pretty big chance or risk that they're the uninformed guys and that they don't really know what the true value in the market is. So, and this means that this is the type of dynamic that is going to decide prices. Now, you could think of that, you know, endogenously, just by seeing how trades play out, and there are sort of models that capture this, these guys, type 2 guys, can actually over time, just by watching the trades, see that, well, you know, there doesn't seem to be any type 1 guys around. And I'm probably the informed guy, so now they change their posterior distribution of what the chance is that they're the informed guy is suddenly close to 100% just by watching the nature of the trades. And now they will then incorporate their information and there will be a price change. And this is a function that shows, derived by Romer, for example, what the price change will be as a function of price when the type 2 guys find out that they are the informed guys. So these are the type of models, and I wanted to go into detail a bit here just to see that, you know, these are the stylized models that can capture these type of big crashes like the 1987 crash. But obviously, if we look at the assumptions they make on, you know, what type of investors are there, they're very, very stylized, right? So they tell a plausible story, but it's difficult to see, well, how should we ever be able to take this to the data? They can sort of ex post explain a crash, but it's not really clear how we're going to use this to model and say something about the stock market in the future, right? Okay, so I'm moving pretty fast here. Any questions so far on what I've... Everything is crystal clear or everything is totally unclear? As you know, if you don't get all the details, it's more about sort of getting the flavor of these models, because we're now going to move on to what... I think can be contributed by more detailed views of what the true information structure and network structure looks like in the market. Okay, so those of you who were here at my September tutorial on asset pricing, you remember there were a couple of key takeaways there. So basically, in the stock market, we got a gigantic amount of data. We got stock prices for all stocks, every second of the day. But this is non-repeatable data, and actually a lot of it is noise. So, for example, if we
think that there's a geometric Brownian motion that decides, you know, that is what is ruling stock prices in a specific stock, and we want to estimate what is the drift term of this Brownian motion. Even though we got this second by second data, it's worthless, right? Because the best we can do is take the two endpoints. I mean, we basically have two data points over the whole time period we're studying. So for a lot of these estimates, there's actually not that much information that we can use. And as the data is non-repeatable, it's you know, we only have one one sample to look at, and therefore statistical significance will be really difficult to get, but it's crucial to have it, because otherwise we can't really trust it. And the key takeaway here is that, well, empirical methods by themselves are not going to help us, you know, convince us totally that this is a true story. We're going to have a theoretical structural model underlying that is plausible, let's say that, well, this is a consistent way of explaining the stock market, and it fits quite well with the empirical data. And I'm a theorist, so I'm actually more interested in the theoretical side here, so that's why, you know, sell this story, why it's so important to have a theoretical model. Yeah.
Just a comment, you know, in the uncertainty area in engineering, it's a very hot topic right now. There's a lot of work that has been done historically in uncertainty models and the parameters and the variables themselves.
Right.
For you know, things including aircraft and cars and so on. Is the community that you hang out with, are they looking at what has been done in other areas and uncertainty? Is there any
Well, there's clearly a big literature on parameter uncertainty and robust control methods,
right.
And so I'm sure they're borrowing from these type of areas. That's not my area of expertise, but they are looking at it, yeah. Okay, so we had a model there where there was some information. You know, we had these type 1, type 2, and type 3 guys, and they incorporated their information over time into asset prices. And the role of information wasn't really studied all that much in asset pricing until, say, the late 70s and early 80s, but now it's become a very hot topic. So up until then, we basically had a view of the world where everyone had the same information. It was all about hedging risk. But then in the 80s, new models were introduced, beginning with Grossman 76, Grossman and Stiglitz 80, Helvig 80, and I'll talk more about the Helvig 80 model. And basically, these models did introduce a heterogeneous population. So we had a lot of different investors, and they all got signals about what the true value of the stock was. And while still we're sort of in a very static world where there are only two periods, you know, there's a true value that will be revealed tomorrow, and then we get a signal today, and then we ask ourselves what are the prices going to be today. So every guy here, just like in the Romer model, gets some price plus epsilon, where the true price is the P is what the true price is going to be tomorrow, but then they get a noisy version, and then we want to see how this is incorporated into prices. And obviously, if we do this the right way, we shouldn't trust only our own signals, which is the Google example I gave you earlier. We should also incorporate the information we actually get from the prices themselves. So quite recently, there have been a new set of models developed where we're sort of going into a more advanced view of how information is incorporated into prices, taking some type of network structure into account. Because here, everyone is sort of on their own island, right? They're sitting and they get their piece of information, and no one gets to see it. And there's basically only two levels in this model. So there's my personal information, my private information, and then there's the information I get from the stock prices. But we sort of know from the network literature and the research on social networks that, well, if I get a signal, then it's you know, quite a big chance that my friend will have some, perhaps I'll, you know, tell my friend the signal, or is it like, yeah, so Peter tells me that his father-in-law just gave him a stock tip that he should buy Enron, and then, you know, he tells me, yeah, you've got to buy Enron, and then I run out and buy Enron, right? So we sort of share our information with each other, and you can see how this sort of, and then I tell my friends, so, you know, a few days later, they all run out and buy Enron, and we can see how this information would be diffused through some type of network, and this will clearly have asset pricing implications. And you know, my view is that it might actually have a very big role in explaining all four of these anomalies in a unified way. There's obviously lots of literature there. The theoretical literature is you know, still developing a lot, and there are some initial models, but there's like no dynamic models here. And also there are some empirical studies that show that these roles of social networks are important in explaining asset prices. Okay, so let's begin with one of the classical models. As I said, everyone gets a private signal here. You want to condition when you decide. So basically, you submit a demand schedule. You get your signal. So V is here the true value of the company in the next period. You get your noisy version of that. And you're now allowed to buy stocks. This is your demand for stocks and your investor number I. As a function of this noisy signal you get, and what the price is in the stock market. So you're allowed to condition on the information you get through the stock market, and then everyone submits a demand schedule. This is how many stocks I want to buy, and then basically we have a market clearing condition, because there are only a finite number of stocks out there, that says that, well, if the supply of stocks is S, then the total demand for stocks should equal the supply. And if you set it up this way, then actually it turns out that the only equilibrium that exists is an equilibrium where the price itself is a sufficient statistic for the best estimate of what the value will be tomorrow. And this sort of means that no one is going to take their personal information into account. They're only going to condition on prices. And this is a very good world in some sense, because, you know, we sort of like information networks where a lot of information automatically is incorporated into one statistic. And obviously for stock markets, you know, in a lot of these models, it turns out that this is the best, you know, an informationally efficient market where we can just go out and say, yeah, the best proxy estimate of what the value of Google is actually what the stock price is today. This is a very good market because it allocates our resources efficiently. However, if we introduce some noise here, so that we actually, there needs to be some type of noise on, for example, the total supply of the stocks. And this is the way so that is typically introduced in the literature. So basically, there's some noise that we just collectively can't find out about on the supply of the stock. And if you introduce this noise, then you actually get equilibria where not all information is revealed. They look something like this, and here you need to be very specific on the distributional assumptions you make. I mean, these models are sort of Bayesian, and everyone updates and have conditional distributions, and there's a market clearing, and they actually become quite complicated to solve, and you need to make quite strict assumptions on what the distributions look like. They basically need to be multivariate normal, and the objective function of investors need to be fairly restrictively defined. But if you do it the right way, then you can get equilibria where some information, but not all information, is incorporated into prices, and you can now ask questions like, yeah, well, you know, how effective are the prices in aggregating information depending on what the type of noise different people have. If there are a lot of people who have very, very precise signals, and then some people that have, or if there's one person that has a very, very precise signal, and then there's a lot of people that have collectively diffuse signals, that might be bad, because now all these uninformed investors, they know that there's someone out there that has so much information that he's going to screw them whatever they try to do, right? And then they're going to stay away from the stock market. Now this guy with the good information, there's no reason for him to be in the market either. So in some, you know, very asymmetric information situations, you can even get something that looks like a market breakdown in these models, because, you know, I'm not going to trade with you because you want to trade with me. Means that I know that you have better information than me, and why am I going to trade with you? And you get these type of effects. So they're, you know, very interesting, and you can get a lot of interesting results, but they don't really capture this social network dimension. Okay, any questions on this type of model?
What do you repeat? Can you give an example of the last phenomenon?
Subprime mortgages, or what?
Oh, where we have a market breakdown.
Market breakdown. Well, so the classical paper is the Lemons problem. Why isn't there a good market for secondhand cars, right? And that's Akerlöf's classical paper from 1970, when he says that, well, you know, if there are, why would you sell your car? Basically, if the car is a lemon, you would like to sell it, right? But me as a buyer, I know that now the only guys who will be in the market will be guys who sell lemon cars, because otherwise there's no reason for them to sell it, and I don't want to buy a lemon car, right? And especially if you're a guy who's sitting on a good car, then you can't sell it, because everyone will believe that it's a lemon car. So it's very difficult to get these markets going when you have this type of asymmetric information. So it's difficult.
I guess it's a good example now with the tranches of mortgages that various people hold, and no one knows what would be sold to them, but they know that if something is sold to them, it's most likely the worst tranche
by owner
X.
Yes. So
breakdown.
Yeah, so I don't know if people have followed this subprime mortgage crisis, but basically there's a gigantic market for securities of these pooled house mortgages that are fairly risky, but you know, people agree that on average they're not that risky, so that the whole market should break down, which is basically what happened since August 8th this year. So they're basically selling at something like 78 cents per dollar, which means that there's an implied risk of 22% that houses will default, which is just, everyone agrees that this is just a way too high probability. I mean, even these are sort of upper tranches, which means that the most risky houses are not part of these securities. And everyone sort of agrees that the objective price of the average security should be something like 90 cents per dollar or something like that, at least. But the thing is that the market breaks down because now that the price is 78 cents, the only person who would go out and sell the asset is someone who actually has an asset that is only worth 78 cents, right? So this is one example where people believe that you have this type of problem right now. Okay. So some empirical studies that have sort of, you know, if we believe that there's a role of this, some type of network, whether it's a social network or something, you know, basically we could have a more general view of what this network is. So we could say that, well, some people watch the CNN news at 9 p.m. and that's when they, you know, call their broker if they can and put in their stock market orders. Then they're sort of related in this network just because they watch the same TV program, right? So we could think of it as a social network, but we can think of it just as some type of correlated ways we get our information from the same sources. If we believe that this is important, then it should have an impact on asset prices. And there are sort of a rising number of studies that study small bits and pieces here and show that they actually do impact asset prices. There's a recent study, for example, by Cohen, Brazini, and Malloy, where they look at mutual fund managers and they look at the educational institution, so where they graduated from, typically with an MBA. And then they compare this with executives and specifically of CEOs at the companies in which these guys invest. And they say that there's a link between these managers if they graduated from the same school. So if both of them got an MBA from UCLA Anderson, for example, and you know this fund manager invests in the company that this CEO has, then they're connected and then they separate the fund portfolio. So all this data is available. So if you're a mutual fund manager, there's sort of really a large scrutiny here. There, you know, basically you need to report everything. So if you buy the Morningstar database, you actually get a little CV of every mutual fund manager, where, among other things, it shows where that manager, which school he graduated at or she graduated at. And the same, you can get hold of the same data for CEOs. So they collected this data, and then they separated the portfolio, which also a fund manager needs to report, at least at a quarterly frequency, into connected and not connected stocks. And then they compared how well did the sub-portfolio of connected stocks perform compared with the sub-portfolio of not connected stocks. And they actually showed a quite significant or a really significant outperformance of these connected stocks versus the not connected stocks. So which sort of supports the story where these guys actually through their social network, or you know, perhaps they got the same information at the school they studied, or they know that this guy is a very competent guy. There's some information just that these guys have that they get from this connection with the CEO, so that they're better predictors of what is going to happen to the stock price for the connected stocks than for the unconnected stocks. And 8.4% per year, is that a big number? Yeah, it's a huge number, right? The stock market returns something like 12% on average per year. So this is almost doubling the return you would get in the stock market. And you might ask yourself, well, why do they even invest in these stocks, right, if they can earn so much? And I don't think the authors, I mean, that's not the objective of their study, but they say something about riskiness and basically, you know, you don't want to put all your eggs in the same basket and things like that. But there clearly, you know, there seems to be a role for these type of networks in asset pricing. Yes, go on. They can, yes, they control for this, and there's actually not a quality. So even when they control, you know, they just look at lower ranked schools, they get the same result. So it doesn't vary with, otherwise you would think that, yeah, all Harvard Business School graduates, you know, they're the ones that outperform. But if you go to, well, I won't say, mention the name here, but I don't want to offend anyone, but you go to, you know, C school that no one knows, you will not outperform. But when they rank it this way, they actually see that, you know, it's independent of ranking, basically. Okay, that's a good question. Okay, so another study, I love this study. So this is a study on bank runs. Kelly O'Grada, American Economic Review 2000. So basically, bank runs happen when investor or depositors in the bank are uncertain whether the bank actually could in principle pay out all the money that has been deposited. So basically, if you're a bank, I deposit my money in your bank, and then you lend out the money to someone else, and that money defaults. Well, now you are having problem, right? Because now it doesn't add up any longer. And obviously, the average bank at a specific point in time, their capital reserve requirement is something like 8%. And, you know, it's regulated by law, which means that if everyone at the same time went to their bank and said, hey, I want my money bank, that would be very, very troublesome for the bank, right? Because they only have 8% of the money in liquid cash, and they would have to go to the people they lended money to and ask to get the money back. So bank runs are bad, and there's a sort of a big literature on what is actually driving these bank runs. Is it information, or could it just be rumors? Because here is, basically the rumor itself that a bank is in trouble might be very, very bad for the bank, because if everyone starts going to the bank and say, hey, I want my money back, that will put it into trouble, even if it's sort of, in principle, a sound bank. Obviously, this is very difficult to study whether, you know, does a social network have a role in this, because, you know, we don't have the data. I mean, we don't know which the investors are and what their social network is. But for a specific data set, they actually, you know, back in the 18th or in the 19th century, there were two bank runs in 1854. There was a set of bank runs, and there was one in 1857 in New York City, where we had all these immigrants that came to New York City and deposited and, you know, opened bank accounts. And there were two big bank runs. And there, we actually have very good data for a subpopulation of Irish immigrants to New York City in the 19th century. So what Kelly and Grada did was that for one specific bank, they had this data. And that bank was very good at collecting information. For some reason, they asked all these questions to their depositors, like, where did you grow up, and where do you live now, and what is your husband's name? So they actually had very, very good data on, and so that they could map out what was the role of these people in, you know, what did their social network look like. And one thing they could do is, for example, they could look at, well, what happened, did people who came from the same county back in Ireland, did they tend to withdraw their money and close their account in a correlated way? And they found a huge correlation here. So basically, there were these floods of depositors that went on the same day, and they all originated from the same county. So this is a graph that shows the percentage of people. So this is sort of a summarized view of this as a function of which county they grew up in Ireland in. And you see that clearly, people from the northern parts of Ireland, they panicked a lot less than people from the southern parts of Ireland. And obviously, they got, well, I don't know what the implications are there, but clearly, you know, this is one of the few data sets we have where we can quite easily, you know, get support for the role of a social network in driving these events. And they also had some hierarchical tree method, because they had all these different data, so they knew how many years the person had been in the country, and obviously they knew the size of the bank deposit. So they had all these different data, and they could basically run some type of a hierarchical tree method where they ranked which explanatory factor is the most important. So for example, is it if you got a lot of money, then you're more averse to these risky bank defaults, so therefore you withdraw your money. But the one factor that was the most important by far was actually county of origin in Ireland. So it actually gave support that these social networks are very, very important in explaining this type of behavior. So, you know, these are just two studies that basically give small pieces of information to the bigger puzzle, which is, you know, trying to have a view of, well, what does this tell us overall for asset pricing? But it sort of clearly shows that these type of networks are important in explaining what goes on in the stock market, at least at the micro level. I'll skip that one. So what do the theoretical models look like that approach these type of problems? Well, so here's a model developed by Ozoilev in 2005. So it's basically this Helbig model I showed you earlier, where everyone is sitting on his own island and doesn't share his information. Well, in Ozoilev's model, you get exactly the same type of information pieces, but you do share them with your neighbor. So it's still a static model where the whole world just lives for two periods, but now at least we have some type of structure. We assume a network structure, so we have this what he calls a social network. So given such a structure and given your piece of information, he can derive solutions for what will the prices look like. And not surprisingly, he get different asset pricing implications compared to what you get if you have this model where everyone sits on its own island. So depending on what the network looks like, you get different degrees of informational efficiency, which is a very important thing to measure in our asset pricing models. And you can also get this excess volatility. So if you recall, that was one of the four anomalies I mentioned earlier on. As it's a static model, you can't really approach the heavy tail distribution anomaly, and you cannot talk anything about, are other returns generated exogenously, or the big shocks, will they occur endogenously or exogenously? You will need a dynamic model to approach these questions. And I think, you know, a very important future area of research is to try to develop dynamic network models and understand what the implications will be for asset prices. And I think sort of the continuous theory of diffusion maps and, you know, how diffusion transfers through graphs over time actually can be very, very helpful in developing these type of models. So this is just my personal opinion, but I think it's sort of very exciting, and sort of the theoretical aspects here are very promising. So in principle, you know, I strongly believe that you could explain these endogenous asset pricing moves if you've got a dynamic network model that looks like this. You could think of some guys sitting at a hub, you know, some very, very connected, informed guy, and as long as the information doesn't reach this guy, there's some type of asset pricing structure. But once this guy gets hold of the information, we're in a totally different regime. He will impact prices and he will change things a lot, right? So you can see how there's delayed information response and how volatility can change over time. And basically all these anomalies that I listed to you are, intuitively, this type of model would have implications and potentially help to explain it. That's the theoretical question, which I'm very excited about. We obviously have an... Yes.
What is it difficult to analyze with discrete agents?
The discrete agents are difficult. So basically, so this goes back to the Helbig model, where I show that, you know, I mentioned that, so everyone is doing some Bayesian updating here, and you've got this huge joint distribution, and you've got an objective function, and you sort of get a large system of nonlinear equations that need to be solved. It just increases, you know, the system of equations increases in number with the number of agents here. And you can tell something asymptotically, so if you let the agents, number of agents go to infinity here, you get some very, very nice pricing rules. But while, as long as they're finite, you actually can just prove the existence of an equilibrium, and you have to rely on numerical methods to solve it. So I think, you know, the ideal setup here would be to have some type of continuous graph here instead, and some density function of, you know, in some high dimensional space. And now I'm really speculating, but if you want to be able to analytically solve this, you will have to have an infinite number of agents, because even at the in the Helbig model and the Zoylev's model, you know, everything is just numerical and it proves the existence, and they can analyze these type of questions. But you know, it's very difficult without more than a handful of investors. It's very difficult to actually analyze what the price function will look like. Okay, so one, well, I wouldn't say weakness, but one thing that is difficult for Zoylev's approach is here that he actually has to prove things that is sort of, he doesn't know what the true network looks like. So he proves theorems like, yeah, for all types of networks it looks like this, or if you got some type of star network, then asset prices look like this. But he can't really have a strong view on, you know, what is the true information network in stock markets, because we don't really know. I mean, we can sort of take the, I don't know, the network of the internet and look at links in on web pages, or you can, someone might study Facebook or something. But it's not clear at all that, you know, obviously it might tell us something, but we don't really have a strong view of what the topology of the information looks like in the market. And that's sort of the empirical question I think is interesting, and I've got a few minutes so we can talk about that. But basically, you know, if you would want to know, you would try to you want to reverse engineer what this network looks like, well, obviously it's going to be very, very difficult. Either you got this fantastic data where, for example, the Kelly or Grada data for a handful of investors, and you know, you actually know who knew whom and you know what their relation was, but on the macro level, obviously you can't do this, right? At least not, you know, you're not going to be able to just study stock prices and try to reverse engineer what the network will look like. But another type of data set that is you know, it's proprietary, but in principle it is available, and we have access to this data set, is if you know every person's trade over an extended period of time, that would, in my view, would help you, you know, it would tell you something about what the network might look like. So this data set is available. We've got the data set for the Turkish Stock Exchange, and obviously it's a very big data set, so it's every trade over 2 years, and we got, obviously, anonymous, but we got some type of number that is unique for an investor. So we can basically follow the path of what every investor did over a two-year period, every investor in the whole Turkish stock market. So it's like 15 gigabytes of data. There's something like 700 million trades. The accounts are in the millions, and the Turkish Stock Exchange contains like 300 stocks. So basically, some type of adjacency matrix should be could be defined here, and you know, we're in the initial stages of doing this, and I would very much like feedback from people here. You could think of, well, if we do sort of tend to do the same thing, so you know, Peter and I, we tend to trade closely in time, so when I sell my stocks, Peter sells his stocks within an hour, that when we're going to be close, right? So you could think of actually creating one big similarity matrix here, where we see that if we tend to be on the same side of the trades in the same point in time, then we're close. Whether that is that we're friends or we're both watching CNN, well, I don't really care, because I'm just interested in, you know, how close are we in the information network, and what are the impact on asset prices here. And on the other hand, if we tend to be on the opposite side, well, then we should be, then we're very, very far away in this network, right? So forming this type of matrix should help us to actually get a view on what does the true network look like, not sort of with this, you know, in the aggregate level of investors. And I think, you know, this is important, because basically, for example, if we talk about heavy tail distributions, well, if we got heavy tails in the connectedness of people, so, you know, in many networks we get these type of power laws where the most connected people are much, much more connected than the least connected people, well, that would, in principle, transform over to heavy tailness in asset prices, because these connected people, once they get a piece of information, that's when the real big thing happens, whereas it's going to be sort of diverse otherwise. So there are several, you know, stylized questions that we would basically want to know a lot of key statistics about these networks, and I think this type of data is the right data to analyze if you want to answer those questions. But these are very important questions for asset pricing, and I would think that, you know, the next 5 or 10 years in asset pricing, Hopefully we'll be able to incorporate the idea of a network information structure to solve, or at least partially resolve, a lot of these anomalies that we have right now. So with that, then those are my final thoughts. And actually, if we have like a couple of minutes, and you know, obviously I'll answer questions, but also if anyone has sort of some strong views of why, what you would want to do with this type of data set, if you would want to answer these questions and which is the right approach, I'd be very, very happy to get feedback on that. So thanks.